surfaced at Kleiner Perkins to leverage my technical background in working with new companies. Andy could not fathom why I would want to leave Intel. He himself put the company ahead of everything, with the possible exception of his grandchildren. He had an amazing ability to reach into your chest and grab your heart, pull it out, and hold it in his hands in front of you. By then, he was the company's president, and he said, "Come on, Dorr. Don't you want to be a general manager and own a real P&L? I'll let you run Intel's software division." It was a non-existent business, but could have been built into one. Then he added a zinger. He said, "John, venture capital? That's not a real job. It's like being a real estate agent." Andy Grove's legacy. When Grove died at 79 after years of stoic suffering with Parkinson's disease, the New York Times called him, quote, "one of the most acclaimed and influential personalities of the computer and internet era." He wasn't an immortal theorist like Gordon Moore, or an iconic public figure like Bob Noyce. Nor did he publish enough to rest beside Peter Drucker in the pantheon of management philosophers. Yet Grove changed the way we live. In 1997, 3 decades after his experiments at Fairchild, he was named Time Magazine's Man of the Year. Quote, "the person most responsible for the amazing growth in the power and the innovative potential of microchips." Andy Grove was a rare hybrid, a supreme technologist, and the greatest chief executive of his day. We sorely miss him.
Dr. Grove's basic OKR hygiene. The crucial qualities of a healthy OKR culture: ruthless intellectual honesty, a disregard for self-interest, deep allegiance to the team, float from the fiber of Andy Grove's being. But it was Grove's nuts and bolts approach, his engineer's mentality, that made the system work. OKRs are his legacy, his most powerful, valuable, and lasting management practice. Here are some lessons I learned at Intel from Grove and his OKR disciple, Jim Lally. They are no less applicable today. Less is more. A few extremely well-chosen objectives. Impart a clear message about what we say yes to and what we say no to. A limit of 3 to 5 OKRs per cycle leads companies, teams, and individuals to choose what matters most. In general, each objective should have no more than 5 key results. From the bottom. To promote engagement and ownership, teams and individuals should be encouraged to create roughly half of their OKRs in consultation with their managers. When all goals are set up top-down, motivation suffers. No dictating. OKRs are a comparative social contract to establish priorities on how progress will be measured. Even after a company objective is close to debate, key results continue to be negotiated. Collective agreement is essential to maximum goal achievement. KR can be flexible. If the climate has changed or an objective no longer seems pertinent as written, key results can be modified or even discarded mid-cycle. Dare to fail. Output will tend to be greater when everybody strives for a level of achievement beyond their immediate grasp. Such goal setting is extremely important if what you want is peak performance from yourself and your subordinates. While certain operational objectives must be met in full, aspirational OKRs should be uncomfortable and possibly unattainable. Stretched goals, as Grove called them, push organizations to new heights. A tool, not a weapon. The OKR system, Grove wrote, is meant to pace a person, to put a stopwatch in his own hand so he can gauge his own performance. It is not a legal document upon which to base a performance review. For the sake of innovative thinking and to prevent sandbagging, OKRs and bonuses are best kept separate. Be patient. Every process requires trial and error. As Grove told his IOPEX students, Intel stumbled a lot of times after adopting OKRs. We didn't fully understand the principal purpose of it, and we are kind of doing better with it as time goes on. In the author's experience, an organization may need up to 4 or 5 quarters to fully institutionalize the system, and even more time than that to flex and build its goal muscle.
Chapter 3, Operation Crush, an Intel Story. Featuring Bill Davidow, former vice president of the Microcomputer Systems Division. Operation Crush, the fight for survival by a young Intel corporation, is the subject of our first extended story on OKRs. Crush illustrates all four OKR superpowers: focus, alignment, tracking, and stretching. Most of all, it shows how this goal-setting system can move multiple departments and thousands of individuals towards a common objective. Now, near the end of my time at Intel, the company faced an existential threat. Led by Andy Grove, top management rebooted the company's priorities in 4 weeks. OKRs allowed Intel to execute its battle plan with clarity, precision, and lightning speed. The entire workforce shifted gears to focus on one prodigious goal. Back in 1971, Intel engineer Ted Hoff invented the original microprocessor, the multi-purpose computer on a chip. In 1975, Bill Gates and Paul Allen programmed the third generation, Intel 8080, and launched the personal computer revolution. By 1978, Intel had developed the first high-performance 16-bit microprocessor, the 8086, which found a ready market. But soon it was getting beaten to a pulp by two chips that were faster and easier to program: Motorola 68000 and upstart Zilog Z8000. So in late November 1979, a district sales manager, Don Buckout, shot off a desperate 8-page telex. Buckout's boss, Casey Powell, sent it on to Andy Grove, then Intel president and chief operating officer. The communique set off a 5-alarm fire and a corporate crusade. Within a week, the executive staff had met to confront the bad news. 1 week after that, a Blue Ribbon task force convened to map out Intel's counteroffensive. Zilog, everyone agreed, was not a serious threat. But Motorola, an industry Goliath and international brand, posed a clear and present danger. Jim Lally set the tone for the war to come. Quote, "There's only one company competing with us, and that's Motorola. The 68000 is the competition. We have to kill Motorola. That's the name of the game. We have to crush the effing bastards. We're going to roll over Motorola and make sure they don't come back again." That became the rallying cry for Operation Crush, whose name was inspired by the Denver Broncos' smothering Orange Crush defense of the late 1970s. Operation Crush, the campaign to restore Intel to its rightful place as market leader. By January 1980, armed with Andy Grove videos to exhort the troops, Crush teams were dispatched to field offices around the globe. By the second quarter, Intel's salespeople had fully deployed the new strategy, and by the third quarter, they were well on their way toward meeting one of the most daring objectives in the history of tech: 2,000 design wins, where a design win is the crucial agreement for a client to put the 8086 in their appliance or their device. By the end of that calendar year, Intel had routed the enemy and won a resounding victory. Now, not one Intel product was modified for Crush, but Grove and his executive team altered the terms of engagement. They revamped their marketing to play to the company's strengths. They steered their customers to see value in long-term systems and services versus short-term ease of use. They stopped selling to programmers and started selling to CEOs. Andy Grove volunteered Bill Davidow, the head of Intel's Microcomputer Systems Division, to lead Operation Crush. Over his long career as an engineer, industry executive, marketing maven, venture investor, thinker, and author, Bill has made many lasting contributions but one is especially dear to my heart. Bill grafted the critical connective tissue, the phrase, quote, as measured by, or AMB, A period M period B period, into Intel's company OKRs. For example, we will achieve a certain objective as measured by the following key results. Bill's AMB made the implicit explicit to all. At a 2013 panel discussion hosted by the Computer History Museum, CRUSH veterans recalled the importance of structured goal setting at Intel and how objectives and key results were used down into the trenches. The OKRs for Operation CRUSH, which you'll find sampled in a few moments, were classics of the genre, time-bound and unambiguous, with every what and how in place. Best of all, they worked. Jim Lally tells me, I was a skeptic on objectives and key results until Grove sat down with me and explained why they mattered. If you tell everybody to go to the center of Europe and some start marching off to France and some to Germany and some to Italy, that's no good. Not if you want them all going to Switzerland. If the vectors point in different directions, they add up to zero. But if you get everybody pointing in the same direction, you maximize the results. That's the pitch that Grove gave to me, and then he told me I had to teach it. As Bill Davidow recounts here, OKRs were Grove's secret weapon in Operation CRUSH. They turbocharged a large and multifaceted organization, then propelled it with surprising agility. Up against a unified, goal-driven Intel, Motorola never stood a chance. Here's Bill Davidow.
The key results system was Andy Grove's way to mold behavior. Andy had a single-minded commitment to making Intel great. He didn't want people serving on outside boards. Intel was supposed to be your life. Your objectives and key results consolidated that commitment. When you're really high up in management, you're teaching. That's what Andy did. Objectives and key results were embedded in the management system at Intel, but they were also a philosophy, a teaching system. They were a fundamental tool. Everybody was taught that if you measured it, things got better. We wrote our top-level goals with Andy during our executive staff meeting. We sat around the table and decided, this is it. As a division manager, I adopted the relevant company key results as my objectives. I brought them to my executive team, and we'd spend the next week talking about what we should do that quarter. What made the system so strong at Intel is that Andy would say, this is what the corporation is going to do, and everyone would go all out to support that effort. We were part of a winning team, and we wanted to keep winning. At the lower level, people's objectives and key results might encompass close to 100% of their work output, but the managers had additional day-to-day responsibility. If my objective is to grow a beautiful rose bush, I know without asking that you want me to keep the lawn green. I doubt I ever had a key result that said walk around to stay on top of employees' morale. We wrote down things that needed special emphasis. Intel's urgency. In December of 1979, I went to Andy Grove's executive staff meeting, full of complaints. I thought the microprocessor people could do a better job. They were acting like a bunch of whipped dogs. You know what I mean. I wanted to goad them into fighting back and believing in themselves again. And then Andy tagged me and told me to solve the problem. CRUSH became my job. The 8086 didn't bring in so much revenue in and of itself. My division sold design aids, software development systems, for systems using Intel microprocessors. We were growing like crazy, but we were dependent on the customers choosing Intel's microchips for their products. This was known as a design win. Once our company got our foot in the door with the 8086, we'd get the EEPROM and peripheral and controller chip designs as well. In total, those sales might be worth 10 times as much as the original sale. There were lots of interdependencies. If the 8086 went away, my system business went away. So the stakes were high. Intel made its money and its reputation as a supplier of memory chips, but we were under siege. Recently, we lost the lead on DRAM, the most widely used and economical type of computer memory, to a startup, and couldn't seem to regain our momentum. Japanese companies were stirring to invade our beachhead in the lucrative market for EEPROM, the programmable, read-only memory chip invented by Intel in 1971. Microprocessors were Intel's best hope for the future. We had to get back on top. I remember one early presentation where the first slide declared, "Crush, the purpose, to establish a sense of urgency and to set in motion critical corporate-wide decisions and action plans to address a life-threatening competitive challenge." Our task force came together on Tuesday, December 4th, and we met for 3 days running, many hours a day. It was an intellectual challenge like solving an enormous puzzle. There was no time to rebuild the 8086, so we spent most of our time figuring out just what we had to sell and how to regain a competitive advantage over Motorola. I thought we could win by creating a new narrative. We needed to convince our customers that the microprocessors they chose today would be the most important decision for the next decade. Motorola could come in and say, "We've got a cleaner instruction set," but they couldn't match our comprehensive product family or our system-level performance. They couldn't compete with our superb technical support or low cost of ownership. With Intel peripherals, we'd remind people you would get your products to the market faster and cheaper. With our design aids, your engineers would work more efficiently. Motorola was a big, diverse company that made everything from two-way radios to pocket televisions. Intel was a technology leader that stuck to memory chips and microprocessors and systems that supported them. Who would you rather call when something went wrong? Who would you count on to stay in the forefront of the future developments? We had a lot of good ideas that needed to be woven together. Jim Lally wrote them on the whiteboard. Publish a catalog of future products. Develop a sales pitch for 50 seminars. And if people come to the seminars, they get a catalog. By Friday, we had a schedule and a plan to mobilize the company. By the following Tuesday, we had approval for a 9-part program, including a multi-million-dollar ad spend, something Intel had never done before. Within a week after that, the strategy went out to the sales force, which was happy to sign on. They'd alerted us to the crisis in the first place. All of that happened before Christmas. Motorola was an extremely well-run company, but it had a different sense of urgency. When Intel executive Casey Powell smacked us between the eyes, we responded within 2 weeks. When we smacked Motorola between the eyes, they couldn't move nearly so fast. I knew a manager there who told me I couldn't get a plane ticket from Chicago to Arizona approved in the time you took to launch your campaign. Intel excelled at declaring great generalizations and translating them into actionable items and coordinated programs. Each of the 9 crush projects became a company key result. Here is an Intel corporate OKR from the second quarter of 1980 for Operation Crush. The Intel corporate objective was to establish the 8086 as the highest performance 16-bit microprocessor family, as measured by: number 1, develop and publish 5 benchmarks showing superior 8086 application family performance. 2, repackage the entire 8086 family of products. 3. Get the 8 MHz part into production. 4. Sample the arithmetic coprocessor no later than June 15th. The engineering department objective was to deliver 500 8 MHz 8086 parts to CGW by May 30th. The key results were, 1, develop final art to Photoplot by April 5th. Deliver Rev 2.3 masks to Fab on April 9th. Get the test tapes completed by May 15th. And Fab red tag run to start no later than May 1. Turning on a dime. Shortly after the first of the year, Bob Noyce and Andy Grove addressed the Intel management group at a crush kickoff meeting at the San Jose Hyatt House. Their directive was simple and clear. We're going to win in the 16-bit microprocessor area. We're committed to do this. Andy told us what we had to do and why we had to do it, and that we should consider it a priority until it was done. With close to 100 people at the meeting, the message penetrated 2 levels of management off the bat, and to a 3rd level within 24 hours. Word spread awfully fast. Intel was close to a $1 billion company at the time, and it turned on a dime. To this day, I have never seen anything like it. Crush could not have happened without the key results system. If Andy had run the San Jose meeting without it, how could we have simultaneously kicked off all those other activities? I can't tell you how many times I've seen people walk out of meetings saying, I'm going to conquer the world, and 3 months later, nothing has happened. You get people whipped up with enthusiasm, but they don't know what to do with it. In a crisis, you need a system in place that can drive transformation quickly. That's what the key results system did for Intel. It gave management a tool for rapid implementation. And when people reported that they had gotten something done, we had a black and white criteria for assessment. Crush was a thoroughly cascaded set of OKRs, driven from the top, but with input from below. At Andy Grove's level, or even my level, you couldn't know all the mechanics of how the battle should be won. A lot of this stuff had to flow uphill. You can tell people to clean up a mess, but should you be telling them which broom to use? When top management was saying, we've got a crush Motorola, somebody at the bottom might have said, our benchmarks are lousy, I think I'll write some better benchmarks. That was how we worked.
2, all Intel field sales engineers, from Andy Grove. Subject, Operation Crush. Operation Crush is the largest and most important marketing offensive we have ever undertaken. It is large in terms of our commitment. It is the corporation's number one key result. It is large in terms of the manpower we have devoted to it, more than 50 man years of crush effort in the next 6 months alone. And it is large in terms of its impact on Intel's revenue, over $100 million in revenue over the next 3 years. The importance of Operation Crush does not come from its size and business impact alone, though. Strategically, the success of this campaign will highlight a significant evolution that has taken place and will continue to take place in our business. We intend to establish ourselves as offering complete computer system solutions in VLSI form. The 4 CPUs, 15 peripheral devices, 25 software products, and 12 system-level products we will be announcing over the next 18 months are the most tangible and meaningful testimonials to the reality of this strategy. Operation Crush represents the articulation of this strategy. As an Intel sales engineer, you will play a major role in making Operation Crush a success. We are counting on your efforts in 2 major areas. Sell our total microcomputer solution. Use the information in this notebook and follow-on material to sell your customers on the need for a complete and integrated microcomputer solution, including both hardware and software, rather than just a set of components. Exploit all of Intel's resources to win current designs. Take a lead in formulating action plans that take advantage of all the Operation Crush resources described in this accompanying material. With your help, I know Operation Crush and the Intel of the 1980s will succeed.
The greater good. Intel stayed on a war footing for the next 6 months. I was in a staff position with no line authority, but I got whatever I needed because the whole company knew how much it mattered to Andy. When the key results came back from Intel's divisions, there was essentially no dissent. Everybody was on board. We redirected resources on the fly. I don't think I ever had a budget. Operation Crush ultimately included top management, the entire sales force, 4 different marketing departments, and 3 geographic locations, all pulling together as one. What made Intel different was that it was so apolitical. Managers sacrificed their little fiefdoms for the greater good. Say the microprocessor division was putting out the futures catalog. Someone might notice, oh my God, we've got a peripheral missing. And that would ripple out to the peripheral division and the allocation of engineering resources. The sales force may have organized the seminars, but they relied on support from the application engineers and marketing, and from my division too. Corporate communications wrangled articles for the trade press from all over the company. It was a total organizational effort. When I think about Crush, I still can't believe we pulled it off. I guess the lesson is that culture counts. Andy always wanted people to bring problems to management's attention. A field engineer tells his general management, "You turkeys don't understand what's happening in the market." And within 2 weeks, the whole company is realigned, top to bottom. Everyone's agreed. The whistleblower is right. We've got to act differently. It was terribly important that Don Buckout and Casey Powell felt that they could express themselves without retribution. Without that, there's no Operation Crush. My name is Bill David Au, and I was the general manager of the Microprocessor Systems Division at Intel.
Andy Grove was accustomed to having the last word, so let's give it to him here. Quote, "Bad companies," Andy wrote, "are destroyed by crisis. Good companies survive them. Great companies are improved by them." So it was for Operation Crush. By 1986, when Intel dumped its formative memory chip business to go all in on microprocessors, the 8086 had captured 85% of the 16-bit market. A bargain-priced variant, the 8088, found fame and fortune inside the first IBM PC, which would standardize the personal computer platform. Today, tens of billions of microcontrollers in computers and cars, smart thermostats, and blood bank centrifuges all run on Intel architecture. And as we've heard, none of this would have happened without OKRs. Chapter 4 is about superpower number 1, focusing and committing to priorities. J.K. Rowling writes, "It is our choices that show what we truly are, far more than our abilities." Measuring what matters begins with the question, what is most important for the next 3 or 6 or 12 months? Successful organizations focus on the handful of initiatives that can make a real difference, deferring less urgent ones. Their leaders commit to those choices in word and in deed. They focus, they commit. And by standing firmly behind a few top-line OKRs, they give their teams a compass and a baseline for measurement. Wrong decisions can be corrected once results begin to roll in. Non-decisions, or hastily abandoned ones, teach us nothing. What are our main priorities for the coming period? where should people concentrate their efforts? An effective goal-setting system starts with disciplined thinking at the top, with leaders who invest the time and energy to choose what counts. While paring back a list of goals is invariably a challenge, it's well worth the effort. As any seasoned leader will tell you, no one individual or company can do it all. With a select set of OKRs, we can highlight a few things, the vital things, that must get done as planned and on time. In the beginning, for organizational-level OKRs, the buck stops with senior leadership. They must personally commit to the process. Where do they begin? How do they decide what truly matters most? Google turned to its mission statement, organize the world's information, and make it universally accessible and useful. Android, Google Earth, Chrome, the new and improved YouTube search engine, these products and dozens more share a common lineage. In each case, the impetus for development came from the founders and executive team who made plain their focus and commitment through objectives and key results. But good ideas aren't bound by hierarchy. The most powerful and energizing OKRs often originate with frontline contributors. As YouTube product manager, Rick Clow was responsible for the site's homepage, the third most visited in the world. The hitch is that only a small fraction of users logged into the site. They were missing out on important features, from saving videos to channel subscriptions. Much of YouTube's value was effectively hidden to hundreds of millions of people around the world. Meanwhile, the company was forfeiting priceless data. To solve the problem, Rick's team devised a 6-month OKR to improve the site's login experience. They made their case to YouTube CEO Salar Kamangar, who consulted with Google CEO Larry Page. Larry opted to elevate the login objective to a Google company-wide OKR, but with a caveat. The deadline would be 3 months, not 6. When an OKR rises to the top line, all the eyes in the company are on your team, Rick Clow says. That's a lot of eyes. We had no idea how we'd do it in 3 months, but we understood that owning a company-level OKR showed that our work took priority. By adding so much emphasis to a product manager's goal, Larry clarified things for other teams, too. As an Operation Crush, everyone rallied to help Rick's group succeed. The YouTube cadre finished on time, though they shipped 1 week late. Now, regardless of how leaders choose a company's top-line goals, they also need goals of their own. Just as values cannot be transmitted by memo, structured goal setting won't take root by fiat. As you'll hear in Chapter 6, Nuna's Jeannie Kim discovered the hard way that OKRs require a public commitment by leadership, in word and in deed. When I hear CEOs say, "All my goals are team goals," it's a red flag. Talking a good OKR game is not enough. To quote the late, great Bill Campbell, the Intuit CEO who later coached the Google exec team, quote, "When you're the CEO or the founder of a company, you've got to say, this is what we're doing, and then you have to model it. Because if you don't model it, no one's going to do it." Communicate with clarity. For sound decision-making, esprit de corps, and superior performance, top-line goals must be clearly understood throughout the organization. Yet, by their own admission, 2 of 3 companies failed to communicate these goals consistently. In a survey of 11,000 senior executives and managers, a majority couldn't name their company's top priorities. Only half could name even one. Leaders must get across the why as well as the what. Their people need more than milestones for motivation. They are thirsting for meaning, to understand how their goals relate to the mission. And the process can't stop with unveiling top-line OKRs at a quarterly all-hands meeting. As LinkedIn CEO Jeff Weiner likes to say, when you are tired of saying it, people are starting to hear it. Okay, the care and feeding of key results. Objectives and key results are the yin and the yang of goal setting, principle and practice, vision and execution. Objectives are the stuff of inspiration and far horizons. Key results are more earthbound and metric-driven. They typically include hard numbers for one or more gauges, revenue, growth, active users, quality, safety. You get it, market share, customer engagement. To make reliable progress, as Peter Drucker noted, a manager must be able to measure performance and results against the goal. In other words, key results are the levers you pull, the marks you hit, to achieve the goal. If an objective is well-framed, 3 to 5 KRs will usually be adequate to reach it. Too many can dilute focus and obscure progress. Besides, each key result should be a challenge in its own right. If you're certain you're going to nail it, you're probably not pushing hard enough. What, how, and when? Since OKRs are a shock to the established order, it may make sense to ease into them. Some companies begin with an annual cycle as they transition from private to public goal setting, or from a top-down process to a more collaborative one. The best practice may be a parallel, dual cadence, with short horizon OKRs for the here and now, supporting annual OKRs and longer-term strategies. Keep in mind, though, that it's the short-term goals that actually drive the work. They keep annual plans honest and executed. Clear-cut timeframes intensify our focus and commitment. Nothing moves us forward like a deadline. To win in the global marketplace, organizations need to be more nimble than ever before. In my experience, a quarterly OKR cadence is best suited to keep pace with today's fast-changing markets. A 3-month horizon curbs procrastination and leads to real performance gains. In High Output Management, his excellent leadership Bible, Andy Grove notes,
"For the feedback to be effective, it must be received very soon after the activity it is measuring occurs. Accordingly, an OKR system should set objectives for a relatively short period. For example, if we plan on a yearly basis, the corresponding OKR time should be at least as often as quarterly, or perhaps even monthly."
There's no religion to this protocol. However, no one size fits all. An engineering team might opt for a 6-week OKR cycle to stay in sync with development sprints. A monthly cycle could do the trick for an early-stage company just finding its product-market fit. The best OKR cadence is one that fits the context and culture of your business. Pairing key results. The history of the infamous Ford Pinto shows the hazards of one-dimensional OKRs. In 1971, after bleeding market share to more fuel-efficient models from Japan and Germany, Ford countered with the Pinto, a budget-priced subcompact. To meet CEO Lee Iacocca's aggressive demands, product managers skipped over safety checks in planning and development. For example, the new model's gas tank was placed 6 inches in front of a flimsy rear bumper. The Pinto was a fire trap, and Ford's engineers knew it. But the company's heavily marketed, metric-driven goals, under 2,000 pounds and under $2,000, were enforced by Iacocca with an iron fist. When a crash test found that a 1-pound, $1 piece of plastic stopped the puncture of the gas tank, it was thrown out as extra cost and extra weight. The Pinto's in-house green book cited 3 product objectives. 1. True subcompact in size and weight. 2. Low cost of ownership in initial price, fuel consumption, reliability, and serviceability. 3. Clear product superiority in appearance, comfort, features, ride and handling, and in performance. Note safety was nowhere on the list. Hundreds of people died after Pintos were rear-ended, and thousands more were severely injured. In 1978, Ford paid the price with a recall of 1.5 million Pintos and sister model Mercury Bobcats, the largest in automotive history. The company's balance sheet and reputation took a justified beating. Looking back, Ford didn't lack for objectives or key results, but its goal-setting process was fatally flawed. The specific challenging goals were met, speed to market, fuel efficiency, and cost, but at the expense of other important features that were not specified, such as safety, ethical behavior, in the company's reputation. For a more recent cautionary tale, consider Wells Fargo, still reeling from a consumer banking scandal that stemmed from ruthless one-dimensional sales targets. Branch managers felt pressured to open millions of fraudulent accounts that customers neither wanted nor needed. In one case, a manager's teenage daughter had 24 accounts, and her husband, 21. In the fallout, more than 5,000 bankers were fired. The company's credit card and checking account businesses plunged by half or more. The Wells Fargo brand may be damaged beyond repair. The more ambitious the OKR, the greater the risk of overlooking a vital criterion. To safeguard quality while pushing for quantitative deliverables, one solution is to pair key results, to measure both effect and counter-effect, as Grove wrote in High Output Management. When key results focus on output, Grove noted,
their paired counterparts should stress the quality of work. Thus, in accounts payable, the number of vouchers processed should be paired with the number of errors found either by auditing or by our suppliers. For another example, the number of square feet cleaned by a custodial group should be paired by a rating of the quality of work as assessed by a senior manager with an office in that building.
So, here's a table with some key results, pairing quantity and quality. Let the quantity goal be 3 new features. The paired quality goal will be fewer than 5 bugs per feature in quality assurance testing. The result? Developers will write cleaner code. If the quantity goal is $50 million in Q1 sales, the quality goal can be $10 million in Q1 maintenance contracts, because sustained attention by sales professionals will increase customer success and satisfaction. Suppose the quantity goal is 10 sales calls. The quality goal can be 2 new orders. The quality of leads, therefore, will improve to meet the new order threshold requirement. The perfect and the good. Google's CEO, Sundar Pichai, told me that his team often agonized over the process. There are single OKR lines on which you can spend an hour and a half thinking to make sure we're focused on doing something better for the user. That's part of the territory. But to paraphrase Voltaire, don't allow the perfect to be the enemy of the good. Or, as Sheryl Sandberg says, done is better than perfect. Remember that an OKR can be modified or even scrapped at any point in its cycle. Sometimes the right key results surface weeks or months after a goal is put into play. OKRs are works in progress, not commandments chiseled in stone. Here's a few goal-setting ground rules. Key results should be succinct, specific, and measurable. A mix of outputs and inputs is helpful. And finally, completion of all key results must result in attainment of the objective. If not, it's not an OKR. Here's 3 examples of weak, average, and strong OKRs. A weak set would be the objective is winning the Indy 500, with the KRs of increasing lap speed and reducing pit stop time. Pretty weak quality. An average quality version of the same OKR would be, yes, win the Indy 500 as an objective, but let the KRs be increasing average speed by 2% and reducing average pit stop time by 1 second. An even stronger set of the same KRs would hold the same objective, namely winning the Indy 500, but let the key results be increase average lap speed by 2%, test at wind tunnel 10 times, reduce average pit stop time by 1 second, reduce pit stop errors by 50%, and practice pit stops 1 hour per day. That's an OKR quality continuum. But less is more. As Steve Jobs understood, innovation means saying no to 1,000 things. In most cases, the ideal number of quarterly OKRs will range between 3 and 5. It may be tempting to usher more objectives inside the velvet rope, but it's generally a mistake. Too many objectives can blur our focus on what counts, or distract us into chasing the next shiny thing. At MyFitnessPal, the health and fitness app, CEO Mike Lee says, "We were putting too much down. There were too many things we were trying to get done, and then the prioritization wasn't clear enough. So we decided to try to set fewer OKRs and to make sure that the ones that really matter are the ones that we set." For individuals, as I found out for myself at Intel, selective goal setting is the first line of defense against getting overextended. Once contributors have consulted with their managers and committed to their OKRs for the quarter, any add-on objectives or key results must fit into the established agenda. How does the new goal stack up against my existing ones? Should something be dropped to make room for the new commitment? In a high-functioning OKR system, top-down mandates to just do more are obsolete. Orders give way to questions, and to one question in particular: what matters most? When it came to goal setting, Andy Grove felt strongly that less is more. He said,
"The one thing an OKR system should provide par excellence is focus. This can only happen if we keep the number of objectives small. Each time you make a commitment, you forfeit your chance to commit to something else. This, of course, is an inevitable, inescapable consequence of allocating any finite resource. People who plan have to have the guts, honesty, and discipline to drop projects as well as to initiate them, to shake their heads no as well as to smile yes. We must realize and act on the realization that if we try to focus on everything, we focus on nothing."
Above all, top-line objectives must be significant. OKRs are neither a catch-all wish list nor the sum of a team's mundane tasks. They're a set of stringently curated goals that merit special attention and will move people forward in the here and now. They link to the larger purpose we're expected to deliver around. Grove wrote, "The art of management lies in the capacity to select from the many activities of seemingly comparable significance the one or two or three that provide leverage well beyond the others, and concentrate on them." Or, as Larry Page would say, winning organizations need to put more wood behind fewer arrows. In very few and focused words, that is the essence of our first superpower. Chapter 5. Focus. The Remind Story. With Brett Kopp, the co-founder of Remind. It's no news that the U.S. education system needs help. A Brown University study pointed to one possible solution: better communication between teachers and families. When summer school teachers made daily phone calls and sent texts or written messages home, their sixth graders completed 42% more homework. Class participation rose by nearly half. For decades, companies have tried to boost student achievement by introducing technology into schools. It hasn't worked. But suddenly, while nobody was looking, tens of millions of American kids walked into the classroom with a transformational piece of tech in their pockets. Thanks to the pervasive smartphone, text messaging became the leading mode of teenage communication. Remind found a market opportunity to make texting a secure and practical communication system for principals, teachers, students, and parents. Focus is essential for choosing the right goals, for winnowing OKR wheat from chaff. Brett Kopp discovered the urgency of focus while building Remind to enable teachers, students, and parents to text in a safe and secure environment. And by using OKRs to zero in on its top priorities, the company is serving millions of people who matter for the future of this country. When Brett and I first met, I was struck by his passion for serving his customers. His startup was exquisitely focused on teachers. I'll never forget stepping into the bathroom of his tiny loft offices and seeing a list of company objectives taped to the mirror over the commode. Now there was a sign of serious goal orientation. I found Brett highly skilled at identifying priorities and enlisting others to buy in. In 2012, he and his brother David made the Forbes Honor Roll of 30 Under 30 Education. But with accelerating scale, their company needed more focus. OKRs guaranteed a process they'd already begun. Here's Brett Kopf.
Growing up in Skokie, Illinois, it was an uphill for me to focus at school. I was fine if I could move around, but sitting at a desk for me was torture. A 40-minute math lesson felt like an eternity. I was the kid who was always messing with my neighbor or blowing spitballs. I just wasn't engaged. I was tested in fifth grade, and then came the diagnosis. Attention Deficit Disorder and Dyslexia, short for ADD. Organizing words and letters was tough for me. Numbers were tougher. But my parents were entrepreneurs, and I'd see them up in the morning at 5 a.m. working. I was working my butt off too, but my grades kept sinking and my confidence with them. It only got worse in high school, on the north side of Chicago. When the other kids called me stupid, I believed them. Until junior year, when a teacher named Denise Whitefield, for short, Miss Whitefield, began working with me one-on-one and absolutely changed my life. Each day, she'd begin by asking, "What do you have to do today?" I'd run down my list, a history worksheet, an English essay, an upcoming math test. Then she'd say something really smart. "Okay, let's just pick one and talk about it. We focused on one thing at a time, and I'd get it done. Just keep trying." She really encouraged me. "You'll get it. I have all day." The panic beating in my chest was subsided. School would never be easy for me, but I began to believe I could handle it. My mom spoke to Miss Whitefield every week and came into school at least once a month. They were a force in lockstep. Team Brett. They would not let me fail. I'm sure I didn't appreciate the importance of their connection, but it planted a seed. My grades got better. The college prep ACT exam, answer 600 questions and don't move for 4 hours, was a horror movie for a person with ADHD, and that is not a lie. But somehow, I made it into Michigan State, my first big win. When people try to solve the country's massive problems in the education system, they usually start with curriculum or accountability, which is code for test scores. What gets lost are the human connections. That is what Remind is all about. Twitter for Education. Like many ventures, Remind began with a personal problem. As a college freshman, I was hopeless with academic deadlines and schedules, which my professors seemed to change on a whim. Cut off from my support system, I failed at three majors before settling on agricultural economics, the easiest one I could find. Even so, I still had 5 syllabi per semester, and each syllabus might contain 35 assignments and quizzes and tests. Success in college is an exercise in time management. When to start writing that 10-page poli-sci essay. How to prep for the chem final. It's all about dynamic goal setting, and I kept dropping the ball. Things came to a head junior year, after a mediocre grade on an essay I'd slaved over. Adding insult, I had to hunt for the lousy grade on a clunky web-based system on my laptop. My friends and I text messaged on our BlackBerries in real time. And I thought to myself, why couldn't our courses be at our fingertips too? Why couldn't teachers connect with students on their smartphones anytime, anywhere? I felt driven to build something to help kids like me. I called my brother, David, who was working in web services security for a big Chicago insurance firm, and said, "You have 24 hours to decide if you want to start a company with me." 5 minutes later, he called me back and said, "Okay, I'm in." For the next 2 years, David and I fumbled in the dark. We knew nothing about technology and less about product or operations. My total real-world experience was an internship at Kraft Foods, where I stocked cookies and crackers. Random students shared their syllabi, and I plugged them into David's Excel macros to send alerts on their phones. "Brett Kopf, you have a quiz at 8 a.m. tomorrow in History 101. Don't forget to study." The system was archaic and certainly unscalable. But for a few hundred active users, including me, it worked. I graduated from Michigan State. In early 2011, I moved to Chicago to work on our app full-time. With $30,000 from family and friends, David and I did the full Monty entrepreneur thing, pasta dinners every night. And we failed because I was arrogant. We spent lots of time meeting potential partners and working up website schematics, but none to understand teachers' problems. We weren't yet focused on what counted. Down to a few hundred dollars, our company cheated death by getting into Imagine K-12, the Silicon Valley startup accelerator for the education market. Our mission statement went something like this. Remind 101, a safe way for teachers to text message students and parents. We're building the most powerful communication platform in education and using SMS as the hook. Think Twitter for education. There are millions of children with learning issues like mine, and millions of teachers struggling to help them. I was bold or naive enough to think we could do something about it. With our demo day opportunity 90 days out, David quit his job and we moved to the Valley. We learned three watchwords for entrepreneurs. Solve a problem, build a simple product, and talk to your users. While David locked himself in a room to teach himself how to code, I focused on a single 10-week goal, to interview 200 teachers across the United States and Canada. With hindsight, that was my first OKR. After emailing a pool of 500 teachers on Twitter, I wound up with 250 one-on-ones, exceeding my objective. When you listen to enough educators in the trenches, you learn pretty quickly that off-site communication ranks high among school pain points. At final bell, teachers were plastering sticky notes, "Homework's due tomorrow," on students' shoulders. Couldn't we do better than that? Traditional phone trees and paper permission slips were labor-intensive and unreliable. On the other hand, texting between 30-year-old teachers and 12-year-old children was loaded with liability. Teachers needed a secure platform with no personal information attached, something accessible yet private. And they needed less work, not more. By day 15, we had a crude beta version of Remind, and we mean crude. On a sheet of printer paper, above handwritten symbols for mobile phones and emails, I scrawled, "Your students can receive messages." At the bottom, there were three options: invite, print, and share. After reaching a teacher on Skype, I'd hold the paper up to the screen and say, "You can literally type any message you want to your students. Hit the button, and they'll never see your phone number or social networking profile." I tried this many times, and the teachers just about fell off their chairs. Every time. "My God," they'd say. "That would solve such a big problem for me." That's when David and I knew we were on the right track. Scaling on a shoestring. By day 70, our software was in place. Teachers could sign up for the web, create a virtual class, and provide a dedicated number of students and parents for text messaging. We scaled quickly, a good sign, 130,000 messages within 3 weeks of launch. We had what every new company wanted, a hockey stick growth chart. On demo day, I entered a big, buzzing room with 11 other startups and hundreds of investors. I had 2 minutes to make my pitch. Then, 2 hours of frantic mingling. I handed my card to at least 40 people. Growth costs money, and by 2012, my brother and I were $10,000 in debt. But then Miriam Rivera and Clint Corver's Ulu Ventures seeded us with the save the day $30,000, and I mean save the day, that literally saved the company. Another infusion followed from Jesse and Manish Arora, the Google product manager who later founded Mighty Text and became my mentor. Manish kept nudging us to back our decisions with more data. Remind kept scaling like crazy on our seed capital shoestring. Sometimes, most of the time, it felt like the Sorcerer's Apprentice, moving really fast and out of control. At one point, we were adding 80,000 users a day with 5 employees, and only 2 of us were engineers. We'd yet to spend a dime on marketing. I talked to teachers for feedback, and they put out the word to 50 colleagues. Since our service was free, we didn't need school or district approval. Our goals remained strictly qualitative until fall of 2013, when we hit 6 million users and raised Series A funding from Chamath Palihapitiya and the Social Capital Partnership. Chamath taught us the quantitative lingo, showed us how to paint a picture with one page of data. He also taught us to see what was inessential, like our number of registered users. Nobody cared how many teachers registered on Remind if they never came back to use it. Now our goals were concrete and upfront. That's how John Doerr saw them posted above our office toilet. We listed three metrics.